Well, good evening again. I greet you in Jesus' name. Let's go ahead and sing a verse or two of our theme song, 510 in the Hymns of the Church. I'm not sure which verses fit the best with the message tonight, but I think we'll just sing the first and the last. I think that'll probably make about the most sense as far as that goes. So 510, Jesus I've Come to Offer, and we'll sing verses 1 and 4 tonight. So if I could have you get the pitch for me, please.
Oh, Jesus, I have come to offer heart and soul to thee forever. Oh, the joys that now appear. Sin ye God, I'll not be hearing. Would I turn from you uncaring? I will not look back again. I will not look back again. What the world and flesh allure me, nothing harsh shall now deter me. Christ for thee my all shall be. If in feeble things I may ever in thine eyes be,
this evening, we will be looking at the next set of verses. It's a pretty big chunk of verses, actually, out of 1 Peter. For those of you who are here for the first time or maybe missed a few evenings, to give you some orientation, we've been studying through the book of 1 Peter, getting some of the ideas from that and maybe trying to see how that applies to us today. And so Peter starts out by making the case that through Jesus, we have become new people, and we walk a life of faith. And the last two evenings, we looked at tests to the holiness that we're called to, because holiness seems to be the theme that Peter is putting forth as the life that we're called to live. And tonight, we're going to be looking at an unpleasant topic, perhaps. And the title is Suffering for Holiness. We looked at some tests, and it could be said, I suppose, that tests of our holiness could be a sort of suffering. But Peter kind of shifts into this topic of suffering, and he makes it pretty clear that he's talking about something other than the tests of life. He talks about suffering. And so we're going to go ahead and read, starting at verse 13 of chapter 3, and read all the way through chapter 4. We're just going to go ahead and read it all at one time, and then and see how these verses might work. I will say that Peter is not the most linear writer, so some of the thoughts that he states pop back up later, stated a slightly different way, and so it can be almost repetitive, but I think he's doing that because he's trying to emphasize some things as well. So anyway, Chapter 3, verse 13. And who is he that will harm you if ye be followers of that which is good? But and if ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye, and be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear, having a good conscience, that whereas they speak evil of you as of evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conversation in Christ. For it is better, if the will of God be so, that ye suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison, which sometime were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. The like figure, whereunto even baptism doth also now save us, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is gone into heaven and is on the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers being made subject unto him. Forasmuch then as Christ hath suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves likewise with the same mind, for he that hath suffered in the flesh hath ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh to the lusts of men, but to the will of God. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you, who shall give account to him that is ready to judge the quick and the dead. For this cause was the gospel preached also unto them that are dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God in the Spirit. But the end of all things is at hand. Be ye therefore sober and watch unto prayer, and above all things have fervent charity among yourselves, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. As every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. If any man minister, let him do it as of the ability which God giveth, that God in all things may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom be praise and dominion forever and ever. Amen. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you, but rejoice inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he is evil spoken of, but on your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, or as a thief, or as an evildoer, or as a busybody in other men's matters. Yet if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God on this behalf. For the time is come that judgment must begin in the house, at the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful Creator. As I said, when you read through this, it's really hard to just break this down as a step-by-step linear argument. And so it might be more helpful to see the main ideas and maybe pick out some of those thoughts, because it does seem as if he's overlapping the arguments or the statements kind of on top of each other. And even if you were paying attention, which I'm sure you were, you'll notice some of the same language coming up that we talked about last night and the night before. Peter does that. 1 John is another book that is that way. When you read through it, it's almost like he's saying the same thing. And the only conclusion that I can come to about that is they really want to get this point across. And I think that's what Peter's trying to do here as well. So what are the main concepts that we should be looking at here? One of the things that the New Testament writers, and Peter especially, seems to pick up on is that suffering is probably going to happen because it happened to Jesus. And that's just something they lived with. They kind of just had this in their bones, as it were, that suffering would happen. And so he says some things that are kind of astonishing when you think about it. Verse 14, for instance, he says, blessed are you, or happy are you, if you are suffering for righteousness' sake. And then you see that in chapter 4, verse 14 as well. Rejoice inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings. This sounds an awful lot like what Jesus would have told his disciples too, right? If you go back to the Sermon on the Mount, this is something that Jesus said, rejoice and be exceeding glad, right? Because your reward is great in heaven. Well, Jesus said that the reward was great in heaven. Peter says in verse 15 of chapter 3 that suffering presents an opportunity for witnessing about the hope of the believer. Now, it's hard to not get into some practical things about this, but that's a fascinating thing to think about, that suffering would be a way to witness. That is not the North American popular Christianity. Instead, it's almost as if that's been flipped around to say that your prosperity and wealth will prove that Jesus is your Lord. It's a very different thing. Peter says, no, that's not the way it was, or that's not the way he saw it. Now, one thing that we've been saying over and over, and I'll just bring it out here again, and that is that this is in the context of a persecuted church. The best I can understand is that Nero was probably the emperor, and we've heard enough about Nero that we know that he was not a kind man to Christians. He saw them as somebody to eradicate from his kingdom. Peter then reiterates a thought that we had looked at earlier on whenever we were looking at how to relate to, well, servants were supposed to relate to their masters back in chapter 2. He mentions there that it's better to suffer for doing right. And he says it again in chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, and then chapter 4, verses 14 through 19. Suffering for righteousness is praiseworthy. Suffering for our faults and failures is, well, what else do you expect, right? That's not something that's, there's no bragging rights. There's no proof in anything when we suffer for our wrongdoing. That doesn't mean anything because it's just kind of what you should get, right? If you do wrong, you should be punished for that. That's just logical the way we've been taught to think. And I think that's true. I think that's the context in which God operates in the world as well. But Peter makes the case here that suffering for righteousness is the purest, what I would call the purest form of suffering that there is. So those are some of the main concepts. Now, he uses Jesus as our example. We've been going over that kind of without saying it, so let's just state it now. But if you look at verses 18 through 22 of chapter 3, he brings Jesus into the discussion. Jesus suffered and died for everybody. And he goes into this language that I am a little hesitant to go into because I don't know what he means completely. But verse 19, for instance, he talks about how Jesus suffered in verse 18. He was put to death in the flesh but raised by the Spirit. And then somehow by the Spirit, he also went and preached to the spirits in prison. And he talks about those spirits in prison down in verse 6 of chapter 4. There's these kind of obscure mentions of preaching to people that are dead, and I'm not astute enough to know exactly what all that means, but it seems likely that he's indicating that in some way and at some time, Jesus met up with Old Testament saints and preached the gospel to them. I think that's what he's saying. It sounds really strange, and I'm not sure how that all worked, but that's the best that I can do with that. And of course, there's some other passages in the Bible that I think might fit into all of that. For instance, the strange story of the resurrection people in Matthew after Jesus was raised from the dead. Have you ever just sat and wondered what that's all about? We could really go down a rabbit trail on that. I don't really intend to do that. I would be glad for any enlightenment that you can give me on that. But somehow, some way, Jesus... And I think the reason Peter wants to bring this up is because it seems as if there was some concern about the dead, some of the people that died before the gospel was fully revealed. And Peter, it seems to me that Peter's trying to bring some level of comfort to his readers that it's okay, like everything's going to be fine because Jesus is taking care of all of that. But anyway, back to the example of suffering. His atoning sacrifice is for everybody. And then we, as his followers, enter into his identity through baptism. He clearly makes that case as well. And he uses Noah as an example. Noah was a man who passed through the waters, as it were. I don't even know why I said as it were. He yes, he was saved through the flood because he was one who trusted God. And we identify in baptism with that passing through the water. And we are saved in the day of judgment. Notice that in verse 21. I wish I would have written it down, but I didn't. There's another translation, and I forget which translation it is, but it mentions in verse 21 where it says, not the putting away of the filth of the flesh. And it says something like, but the, I'm gonna botch it, so I better not try, but it's something like being ready to be judged. And so in a sense, what baptism does is that it makes us, it's a showing that we are entering into this life and we are prepared to make it through judgment, just like Noah made it through the judgment through the water. Peter puts those things together and makes a symbol out of that for us. And so he did it. We can think of it that way. Another point that Peter makes about Jesus as our example, he suffered for doing right. Jesus did not do anything wrong to deserve his suffering. The gospel writers make that very clear. When he's facing off with Pilate, Pilate says, I don't find any fault in this man. But the Jews said, crucify him anyway. And so he ended up trying to wash his hands of it. We know that story didn't work out so well for Pilate, did it? But Jesus did not do anything wrong. And so as his followers, we should be prepared for suffering for doing right. Also, notice in chapter 4, we are called to think of ourselves, we're to arm ourselves with the same mind that Christ had. And so he goes into this little passage then talking about how suffering in the flesh means that you've ceased from sin. And what I understand from that passage is that when we are willing to forego things in the flesh, even our right to life, which is what Jesus did, right? He should have had the right to live, but he gave that up. And by doing so, he made the clearest line between righteousness and sin that you can possibly make. When we are willing to actually deny ourselves to the point that our lives are given up, then we can say we have truly ceased from sin. Do we become sinless? That's another discussion. But the point is that we have made it clear that our loyalties are not with our flesh. It is with Jesus Christ. And so we identify with Jesus in that. And that's what he's calling us to do. And then he goes on and he says, this is going to be weird. Just be prepared for people to think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you. And so Peter says, be prepared for people to look at you and say, y'all don't do what we do, and so you're odd. It's strange. And they're going to twist it around to make it sound like you're doing something bad rather than doing something right. And so Peter says, you should be prepared for this. Now, remember earlier on, we talked about how Peter seemed to think that if you were in a situation like this, if you respond rightly, then the hope is that people will be converted, right? But it's almost as if Peter's recognizing the reality that that's not always going to be the case, that there are still going to be people that are just determined to see something good as bad. And we certainly live in times like that now. Peter saw that in the time of Rome. Do we live in days like that? Yes, there are people who are determined to call evil good and good evil. And so we should not be surprised by this. Now, we haven't faced this kind of suffering for it, but anything's possible when a society gets to a place like that. And so Peter just says it's going to be that way. Don't think it's strange. It's, you know, don't be surprised. But live as though you are going to be judged by someone who is capable of judging. In other words, if human beings want to say that righteousness is evil and evil is righteousness, let that go. That doesn't matter. But there is one who is ready to judge those that are alive and those that are dead. And that's the one that you should be prepared to give account to. That's what Peter's saying here, I think. You don't have to worry about what the Gentiles say. And then Peter again, as in that verse 6, They are judged justly. There's no unjust judgment with God. One of the other key points that Peter makes in this discourse on suffering, and one that I've been just kind of rolling around in my mind for the last several weeks, and one of the reasons I ended up deciding that Peter had everything in it that I wanted to say, or a lot of the things I wanted to share here, was I kind of had in the back of my mind, if the Lord would lead, that I would preach a little bit about this path to glory. The New Testament writers are not shy about saying that suffering is the path to glory. And he says this several times. Notice we just talked about verse 1 of chapter 4. We're supposed to think like Christ. We're supposed to be prepared to suffer. But then he goes over in verse 13 of chapter 4, be partakers of Christ's suffering, so that when his glory is revealed, you will be glad in that glory as well. And there's another verse that's in chapter 5 that we'll probably talk about a little bit tomorrow evening, but it talks about being called into his glory after you have suffered a while. We use that sometimes as a benedictory prayer. And it's an interesting little twist of phrase there, that after we've suffered, then we are called to glory. And the New Testament, Jesus' kingdom turns everything upside down. You would think that glory would come from being Pilate, right? That's where glory is. That's where you get recognition. You have power. You have the ability to put a man to death. But Jesus' glory comes through the death, and that's the glorification, and then he's raised again in power, and he's going to return in power like we heard about in our devotion. And as Christians, we walk that same road. Peter tells us that that's what we should be prepared to do. And so if we are reproached, verse 14 of chapter 4, if we're reproached for the name of Christ, we can be happy because the Spirit of glory is resting upon us, the Spirit of God and of glory. And we show forth God's glory in that way. And again, in verses 17 down through, it talks about the judgment beginning at the house of God. And I think it's simply meaning that kind of what I said last night, and that is the gospel needs to work at home, right? And so if our gospel isn't working in our life, in our brotherhood, in the house of God, as it were, then it's not, there's no hope for anything else. Now, I skipped over some verses, chapter 4, verses 7, 8, and 9, and then through about 11, I guess. Why does Peter put this little bit in here? In the context of suffering, why does he throw this in here? Well, I talked about this just a little bit last night, I think, or one of the evenings. I think he's basically reminding us again that when we are in the middle of suffering, the temptation will be to turn on each other. Why is it that we do that? He wants us to remember that in the journey of life, it's going to take focus, it's going to take clarity, it's going to take watchfulness, prayer, and fervent love for each other to make this through, because we all need each other. And that, I think that's what he's talking about then in verses 10 and 11, where he talks about these gifts that are given. If any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. It sounds a little bit like something Paul would say in Romans, you know, if anybody has the gift of ministering, you know, all that. I think that in the context of suffering, Peter is saying you need everybody. And remember that you may be suffering persecution, but your brothers and sisters are also suffering the same thing. And so therefore, we help each other. We have great love for each other. And I know we trip up over this phrase, for charity shall cover the multitude of sins. And I'll maybe talk about that in just a little bit. So some applications for tonight's passage. I've been mixing them in somewhat, but I'm going to try to get just a little more plain with what I think Peter wants us to think. Now, tonight, we may struggle to think about how this passage applies to us, because I don't feel like I've ever suffered for my faith. I would be interested in knowing how many of you would feel that way. Honestly, have you really, truly suffered? Other than maybe getting your feelings hurt because somebody laughed at the way you dress or something like that. I don't consider that persecution. If that's persecution, we're really weak, right? These people were being chased down and put to death. Peter was crucified. This was a serious matter for them to talk about suffering this way. So one of the things I want to get out of the way, I don't think that suffering is necessarily I don't think we should go seeking suffering. In other words, there've been Christian people through the years that think that they're not suffering, and so they need to somehow inflict suffering, and so then that leads to these weird things where they hit themselves with whips and things like that. So that's one way. The other thing I've heard people kind of speculate, and I'm not sure, I'm not visionary enough to really connect with this idea, but we North American Anabaptist Christians aren't being persecuted, so maybe it's because we've been too quiet. Maybe if we would go and march on the abortion clinics, and maybe if we would go and do some things, we would bring some persecution on ourselves. Well, you might, actually. you might be able to conjure up some persecution if that really makes you feel better. But I don't know that that's necessarily what Peter would recommend. I think if Peter knew of a way that he didn't have to be crucified, he would have been okay with that. But because they were living in that political context, it made sense for them to see themselves as suffering Christians. In fact, my understanding is, as the Anabaptists came out of the Reformation and came to a land of peace, they weren't quite sure who they were because they weren't being killed anymore. So it was a little bit of an identity crisis for them. And maybe, in that sense, persecution would be helpful. I'm going around and around this whole thing of saying, I don't think there's anything wrong with living in peace, but it does perhaps lend itself to some negative ways of thinking, perhaps. For instance, I mentioned one already. In America, it's almost as if this whole concept has gotten flipped around, that if you're suffering, you're doing something wrong, whereas the New Testament writers would say, no, if you're suffering, you're actually doing something right. And so I think living in a land of prosperity and peace can lend itself to a bad concept of what Christianity is. Does that make sense? That you follow that? Because we don't believe in wealth, health, and prosperity gospels, do we? I don't believe in that gospel. But we live in a culture that says suffering in any form is not allowed. You're not allowed to suffer at all, ever. And so you should go way out of your way to make sure that all suffering is gone. And I mean, I'm talking everything from a simple headache to whatever. And the question remains, has that made better Christians? Has the lack of suffering produced better faithful followers of Jesus? And I think this fairly strong case could be made that not necessarily. Now, again, I'm not saying we should go seek suffering. I'm just saying that to believe and to follow the American dream of no pain at all, no suffering at all, is probably not going to be helpful either. So how are we supposed to think about suffering? What is the message for us today? Well, another thing to think about is that Jesus' path to glory was through suffering. There's a fascinating passage in Hebrews, if I can find it now. I thought it was in Hebrews 12. I just wrote Hebrews 12 down and I didn't verify the verse. Does anybody know where I would find the verse that talks about Jesus learning obedience through the things that he suffered. I'm just not laying my eyes on it right now. I'm sorry, I should have written that down. I wanted to read some of the verses in Hebrews 12 eventually, and I thought that's where I would find that. Well, I'm sorry. I feel bad about that. But Jesus did learn obedience through the things he suffered. That is a phrase that I know is in the Bible somewhere. I didn't just make that up. And it's interesting to think about that Jesus himself, in some way, in his human capacity, had to learn obedience through his suffering. And I've come to understand that the suffering that we face, and it's not necessarily external pressures and persecutions, but I believe that the Christian concept of suffering is that we are being taught. And that's where I want to go to Hebrews 12 next. And maybe I'll find my verse. I'm not sure. Thank you. Hebrews 5. So it's back farther. Thought it was in Hebrews 2. Yes. Thank you. So in Hebrews 5, yes, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him, called of God and high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Thank you for that. Now, back to Hebrews 12. So, after the Hebrew writer tells us about all of these people of faith, he says, wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. So here we have a group of people that may fit our situation just a little better. And I think that this is the kind of suffering that maybe we need to think about. Verse 5 of Hebrews 12, and ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children, my son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. This is the Christian concept that I think fits the best for us to think about suffering, because to think about suffering coming from external forces like people inflicting suffering on each other, that isn't necessarily our case so much. But in Hebrews 12, it's clear that if we accept the things that come into our life that feel like suffering, and there are things that we suffer. I'm not minimizing that at all. There are people here, those of you tonight, some of you I know, have been through much, much harder things than I have been. And I don't completely understand that. Maybe we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But so the whole goal of suffering, Peter sees as a way to enter into glory. And I think that that's the Christian concept. And so we respond in humility and obedience to the suffering that is in our lives, and then we become the children of God through that. It's to be formed into the image of God's Son, I believe, is what suffering is trying to do to us. So then the question comes, where does suffering come from if it's not other people doing it to us? There's another danger, I think, in our culture, and maybe it's existed longer than just North American easy Christianity, I'm not sure. But this idea to blame God for suffering, because we see God as this big, amazing God, and we should see him as a big, amazing God. We see him as in control of everything, and we should see him in control of everything. And so if that's the case, then the logic goes something like this. Why does God let bad things happen? And so I want you to think carefully about that. If you've ever asked that question, you are on a path that's pretty dangerous. That's a very bad place to be because, well, I'll try to explain why. Let's think a little bit about the Old Testament. We've been going back into the Old Testament several times. I want to just rely on your memory because I can't take you to every passage. But when the Israelites were suffering, even at the hands of other people, what was their response? God, how could you let the Babylonians come and take us out of our homeland? Did they ever say that? Well, maybe some of them did, but the recorded response is, we have sinned, and we have broken thy law, and so we're sorry. My point in that is that much of human suffering comes because we do not live like new people. We are breaking the moral code of the universe that God put into place, and that brings untold amounts of suffering. How many people have died because people have disobeyed God's moral law? Millions. So for us to pretend as if we don't understand where suffering comes from is a little bit naive and maybe a little bit blind. Now, that, I think, I don't know percentages, of course, but to recognize that human beings themselves are responsible for most of the suffering, it accounts for a large percentage of the suffering in the world. It really does. And it accounts for a lot of suffering, even in small ways. Just let's boil this way down. Some of the suffering that we go through is self-inflicted because we break the code too. For instance, when your father chastens you after their own pleasure, for instance, when you tell a lie to your parents, you suffer those consequences because you've broken a code, right? And when you fly off the handle at your children, you suffer some consequences because you've broken a code. And so that's a tiny little bit of suffering, right? We haven't striven, we haven't resisted unto blood, striving against sin. But it does bring a certain amount of suffering into our lives. So a lesson that we can learn from the Old Testament saints or the Old Testament Israelites is to recognize that we have sinned, and that accounts for a huge, huge part of human suffering, and that goes across the entire globe. And there's no telling at all what could happen if everybody would abide by God's ultimate code. And I think that's what we'll get to see in the millennial reign. God will be showing us what could have been. That's kind of what I think. You can take me to task on that later if you care to. Now, that what I just described, people inflicting suffering on each other, we can't blame God for that. Because to blame God for that, then we would have to back up and say, well, God, you should have never left us be free. I don't know about you, but I kind of like to be free. And I kind of want you all to be free. I want to be able to have meaningful, free relationship with God. And he wants to have a meaningful, free relationship with us. Now, this we're getting out into some maybe metaphysical things to think about. But what would we be if we weren't free? Well, then it would be God's fault, I guess. Now, this does not explain things like cancer. It doesn't explain things like tragic accidents. It doesn't explain those kinds of things. And everybody suffers something in their life. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the, I don't know what he was. Was he a psychologist, Viktor Frankl? He was a German who ended up in the Auschwitz, I think I'm saying that right. And that was a terrible place to be. And he wrote a book one of the books he wrote, it was Man's Search for Meaning. And he made the case in that book that you could tell who was going to live and who was going to die. And you knew it beforehand. And he survived because he found meaning in that suffering. He found a way. I don't even know if he would claim to be a Christian. I don't know about that. The only reason I'm bringing that up is because sometimes people that have been through some terrible things have some things to teach us, and that's not our subject tonight, about what all he thought. But what he did say, he came to the States then later, and he would lecture on how he survived Auschwitz. And he would talk to psychologists, and psychologists sometimes, he would ask for questions or whatever, and they would be very quiet. They didn't know what to say. And so he asked somebody that was in charge of the lecture or whatever, he said, why are these people so quiet? And they said, because they feel guilty. They haven't suffered like you have. And so he felt compelled then to make it clear that he was only using his experience in Auschwitz as an example. He said everybody has their own Auschwitz, meaning that everybody suffers things that they're going to have to find their way through. And you can go to humanism to try to find those answers, but the Christian answers it here. Like, it's already been given to us. And so I want to just kind of leave that psychobabble aside for now. But if you're suffering tonight, or you know somebody who is suffering, and you're tempted to ask why, and it's not because somebody has broken a moral code as such, because I told you already that I think that accounts for a huge amount of suffering that people do because they sin. But there are things that happen. It just seems that it happens, and it's like, well, then what's God up to there? Why would he do that? Well, why would he do that? The easy answer is to say, well, we sinned and we brought a curse to the world. Well, that's true, but it falls somewhat flat, in my opinion. That answer sounds just a little too flat. And so what has become more meaningful to me is to think of it as a way that God is trying to affect something in my life if I respond properly to it. And we have that choice. And so you can think of examples of things that don't make sense. Job, for example, it's a book that Christians have looked at for years and years, and even Old Testament people probably read the book of Job. Job is a book that only makes sense if you see the background picture, which is given to us, right? Put yourself in Job's shoes. You don't know that conversation that Satan's having with God, however that happened. I don't understand that at all. But we don't have the insight there. So Job's just happily going about his life, and then these awful things happen. Did he break a moral code? Well, God said he was a perfect man, right? He was upright in all his ways. He hated evil. And so it could look like, well, God's to blame. Because God kind of baited Satan into that, didn't he? Like, what's up with that? Anyway, another story that can puzzle you, if you let it, is the story of James and Peter. Why is it that James was beheaded and Peter gets out of jail? Why? Well, I don't know. And then you have that story in the book of John about a man that was born blind, and his disciples came to Jesus with the question, who did sin? Well, that sounds like a question we would ask, right? And Jesus says, no one. But something big is going to happen in this man's life. God's going to be glorified. The fact that the whole reason I'm looking at this is because when we start asking the question, why did God not stop something? The fact remains that there are purposes that are so far beyond our comprehension that we may never know. And I know some people... and maybe I've done it too, and if you've done this, please don't feel like I'm criticizing you, but I know of people sometimes that are going through some awful suffering, and they're like, I can't wait to ask God what the point of all this is. I would even caution you against an attitude like that, because you're still basically sitting in the judgment seat and saying, God, I get to try you. And I wonder, I wonder, I don't know, never been there, but I wonder if when we somehow cross over into that world, I'm suspicious it won't even matter anymore. That's what I'm suspicious of. That probably when we get there, the fullness of the presence of Jesus will be so much that it just doesn't matter anymore. And we'll know at that point that we have been glorified through our suffering. I think we all know people who have risen above these amazingly crippling odds, people that have done some amazing things and have become very useful and gracious and generous through terrible suffering. It looks like meaningless suffering. What? How did they do that? Well, back to Viktor Frankl, if I may. What he did say about people in those prisons, he said you could tell the people who were going to die because they gave up. They just stopped doing whatever. They wouldn't help anybody. They just crawled into their bunks. They stopped eating, and they would just, no, they would eat. They would just eat all their bread. They would smoke all the cigarettes that they were given, and they just turned inward. And at that point, he said, you could tell that they were going to be dead in days. They were gone because their suffering had become purposeless, and they turned inward. What got him and other people through those horrible, horrible things was the ability to look outside of themselves and always find someone who was less fortunate than they were. And what I just said about people that have risen above those odds, I told you that they become useful and they are usually generous. And that, I think, is the key. And I think that if we can take suffering and turn it into something like that, that we recognize that there's always somebody who is in worse shape than we are, and we can find ways to reach outside of ourselves, and maybe not even necessarily in worse condition than we are. Okay, that's kind of a pointless comparison, but to realize that other people have their suffering and we become generous, then the suffering has had its effect. We have been formed into the image of Christ. And at that point, we're making clean breaks with sin. There's lots of good things that happen when we recognize that suffering can have meaning. And we begin to walk in that reality in this life. And then I think that's why I would kind of go with the idea that it just doesn't matter when you get to the next life. And then you're living in that new world, and there's endless opportunities to serve God. And I don't even know what all that looks like. I'm pretty sure we're not just going to sit around and sing, but I think there's going to be amazing ways to serve God and worship Him in a more full way than we ever have been able to here. And of course, we've seen the opposite. We've seen people that go through suffering, they become more and more bitter and inward and selfish, and you can't even talk to them without them bringing up all of their problems. And I want you to notice something in verse 8 of Hebrews 12. He says, if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers. What is he saying there? Because most of what I was talking about, the suffering that we face, is indiscriminate. In other words, unbelievers face it just as much as believers, right? It's not like persecution for righteousness' sake. That seems to be geared more toward, but then you could kind of go down a rabbit trail there, and that is that even false religions sometimes are persecuted by what's supposed to be the true religion of Christianity, and that gets really murky. But all suffering, all chastisement, everybody gets it, right? So what does he mean then in verse 8 that if you be without it, who's the lucky person? Who's the one who gets away with no suffering, no chastising at all? I'm not sure how to work through all of that, because he says almost exactly the opposite in the very next phrase, whereof all are partakers. And so it leads me to this belief, and that is that it depends completely on how you respond to the chastisement, whether or not you prove that you are a son or not. That's what I think he's saying. And you can think about it as biological children, right? You can think about your own sons or daughters. Eventually, if they do not heed you as a parent, if they resist the chastisement that you bring into their life because you're trying to make them into a better version of what they should be and lead them to a place where they can become useful human beings in the world. And think about what I just said. That's what Christianity is doing, right? It's making us into people who are fit for the next world. That's what Christianity is. And we're being formed into what God wants us to be formed into. And so if our children don't respond to us correctly, eventually it gets to a place where the relationship breaks. Yes, you would still say they're your son, and that's or daughter, and I'm not prepared to go through the theological arguments of all of that. I just want us to think about what happens to a relationship when a child continues to reject the teaching and chastising of the father. Things break eventually, and eventually that person becomes unlike, like completely unlike what the father hoped they would be. It's interesting that Hebrews also mentions helping each other out in the context of suffering and chastisement. You see, when we do face suffering, whether it's external persecution or whether it's just simply the result of people around us breaking the moral code of God, or whether it's simply just what looks like completely random acts of evil that happen upon us, everybody has their Auschwitz, right? Everybody has their own version of suffering that they're facing at any given moment. And so Peter and the Hebrew writer both put in there, watch out for each other, take care of each other, because we are going to need each other to get through this journey, right? None of us are alone. And one of the other things that can happen in suffering is that we turn inward in the sense that nobody's going to know. And yeah, we don't want to go around just telling everybody all of our problems all the time, but we are going to need the prayers and the care and the love of everybody if we're going to make it successfully in this journey of being formed into God's image, or the image of his son is what I meant to say. And so tonight, I don't know if it's a revival message or not, but it certainly is a real issue that we face. And we are given ample opportunity, whether we are being persecuted or not, to be trained to obedience through the suffering that we face. And we have the choice to become, well, what's the catchphrase? To become better or bitter. We really do have that choice. And don't be bitter, because you'll die. You'll die spiritually. You'll die physically, probably sooner than you need to. But be the people that are sons and daughters and become what God wants them to be through suffering. I don't think we'll do an invitation tonight. Let's just stand for closing prayer.